Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Across the country, back-to-school plans are tentative at best and a mess at worst. Could pandemic pods be the answer?
I think it's a really cool idea, kind of like a co-op homeschool education.
We have about 12 kids between the ages of 6 and 12 on our street, and we're considering having backyard classes.
The pod cost would be about $2,000 per child each month.
We're not going to send our children to public school so they can get coronavirus and spread it to everybody in my family.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today in the takeaway from Monday, August 3rd, inside the small group learning pod model and how it could affect the educational divide in the U.S. Also on the show, COVID-19 testing is as critical as ever, and it's supposed to be free.
I received a bill for $1,888.
We'll talk about how to make sure you get a free or affordable test. And on the anniversary of one of the nation's deadliest acts of anti-Latino violence, we check in on El Paso. But first,
if you have high caseload and active community spread, just like we're asking people not to go to bars, not to have household parties, not to create large spreading events, we're asking people to distance learn at this moment so we can get this epidemic under control.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. As the coronavirus continues to make its way across the country, school districts nationwide are scrambling to create plans that will work for staff members, students, and parents. And while the health of students is the main concern this semester, many parents are also worried about their children falling behind academically. Last week, New York City, the largest school district in the country, announced its plans for reopening schools, which include closing classrooms rather than entire school buildings if a student or teacher becomes sick. Those plans were strongly criticized by the Justice Caucus of the New York City Teachers Union, which called them, quote, confusing and absolutely frightening. And at least one other school district in the United States is already serving as a cautionary example. A student at a junior high school in Greenfield, Indiana, tested positive for coronavirus on the first day of in-person learning last week. And now some families are learning to create learning or pandemic pods, alternative education systems for their children. Some families are pooling resources to pay private teachers or babysitters. Others are splitting the education work among themselves. But these pods will be shaped by the resources families have at their disposal. And some experts say that they have the potential to increase inequality in the education system. And we asked you if you're considering educational options like learning pods for your children.
Hi, this is Tracy from Alameda. We have about 12 kids between the ages of 6 and 12 on our street. And they've been playing together through the whole pandemic, and we're considering having backyard classes to keep these kids together so they don't have to go back to school.
Hey, my name is Skylar Davis. I'm from Bradenton, Florida. I am a nanny for a family that is considering one of these pods for their kids' education. I was homeschooled, so I'm all for it, and if that's what we've got to do to get kids in a good education, if they can't go back to school, at least have them do some socializing and have them give the parents a break.
My name is Chris. I live in Barrie, Vermont. We prefer to homeschool. We're not going to send our children to public school so they can get coronavirus and spread it to everybody in my family.
This is Alexis from Marin County, California. My seventh grader was invited to two pods. But she did well with remote learning. The pod cost would be about $2,000 per child each month. And I want to give the teachers a chance to succeed instead of assuming it won't be a structured academic year.
This is Cheryl Lynn calling from Seattle. Regarding forming pods with kids and other children as an alternative to school, the concept just furthers educational inequality and ableism. How does a pod accommodate students receiving special ed services?
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Keep telling us your stories. For more on education pods and the way forward for kids this fall, I have Prudence Carter, professor and dean of the Graduate School of Education at Berkeley, where she focuses on education inequality. Prudence, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Christina Samuels, associate editor, for Education Week covering educational equity. Christina, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me as well.
Christina, how expensive could some of these options end up being? We just heard $2,000 a month per kid. Is that about right?
Sure. Well, you know, I think it varies quite a lot. Some parents are definitely looking at having teachers really come in and provide instruction. And certainly when you're talking about that, you're going to be going on the upper end of the varying costs here. But this does range all the way down to maybe parents just saying, you know, can we bring in a babysitter or some teen or young adult who might just be able to supervise our children while they go through whatever the district has planned for them. And in that case, you might be having, a smaller cost, but obviously there's still resources that need to be expended for this.
And Christina, just in terms of are what we're hearing right now anecdotal stories, or are there any data on how many parents might be considering leaving public school districts to pay private teachers to create these pods?
I think that at this point, what we have here is a lot of anecdotes. Now, of course, you know, I mean, the conversation is strong. It's going on in you know, lots of places in the country. But I think it's going to take a little while for us to know how this actually plays out in terms of school enrollment, because it is meaningful, and disruptive, even in the midst of all this disruption, to actually disenroll your child from school. So I have a feeling that, you know, that's going to be something that'll have to shake out, as we start to get student counts. Usually that's in sort of like the late September, October timeframe, when districts have to really report how many students do we have enrolled.
Prudence, for parents who are planning to leave their children in school, for parents who are planning to use pods, how could that deepen certain inequities in our school system?
Well, first, it will deepen inequities if those kids who come from economically vulnerable communities do not have access to this kind of supplemental support. And in some ways, it's primary support. So if you have parents with means, with more affluence, who are actually getting this kind of small group learning for their kids, and you have other kids who actually won't have access to a better quality instruction or supplemental instruction, then you're compounding what we already call academic disparities, or some people refer to them as achievement gaps.
And Prudence, I've seen, on Facebook, I've seen some groups emerge that are specifically for students and parents of color. We know that in a recent national poll done by Axios and Ipsos, Black and Latino parents said they were far more likely to consider it risky to send their kids back to school this fall. But Prudence, how do those factor into what we're seeing with the creation of these pods? I mean, do we see that there will also be racial inequities magnified as a result of this?
Well, there are two things to say about that. First, we don't know the extent, and this is a concern of mine, that most of the attention focused on learning pods has been focused on middle and upper class families. It may very well be the case that in economically vulnerable communities, there are things happening. We know that nonprofit organizations are actually creating, some are creating learning hubs, which may be slightly larger than pods, but there is equity work going on the ground in various communities around the country. So that's the first thing. The second thing, when it comes to race, it is the case that more families who identify as Black and Brown or of color are more likely to prefer to be at home, but we have class variation as well. So middle class and upper class Black and Brown families may have more means to actually have their own learning pods or pandemic pods, and you may have families with lesser means who may not be able to do that. So it's hard to just say blanketly what's going to happen in terms of race, and this is a point that I've made, that we should not be conflating race and class, because people like myself who are middle, upper middle class are actually can't afford to do it, and some of us are subscribing to the idea that we may want to create small learning pods in our own communities.
Christina, what about regulation for homeschool curriculums? I'm wondering, because there are parents who are just saying, you know what, forget the pods, I'm just going to homeschool my child. myself. And one of the things I'm seeing is a lot of sharing of resources, particularly on Facebook groups. People will say, look, there's a great yoga class, or here's a great mindfulness curriculum, or here's a wonderful unschooling curriculum. But that feels to me like there is no standard homeschool curriculum, that your kid could basically learn anything. Is that right?
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, a great deal of variation in the states about what actually entails homeschooling. Some states do have a little bit more, you know, sort of oversight into this than others. But yeah, I mean, the whole, you know, reason behind homeschooling is that, you know, this is a family that is actively wanting to disengage from what the school system has to offer. I think in this case, though, at least what might be driving it here is not necessarily sort of a philosophical opposition to what school is offering, what the, you know, traditional districts are offering, but just the logistics of what districts are beginning to ask of parents. We had a taste of what that would look like in the spring, and now many districts are coming back and saying, like, okay, well, what you were doing in the spring, but longer, you know, several more hours, how about that? And I think that people are just saying, they're not trying to say, like, well, we no longer want to teach our children math. They're just trying to say, how can we handle however many hours of synchronous learning in our day and also work at the same time? And I think that that might be the energy that would be driving homeschooling, not a rejection of the academics of districts, but just sort of a rejection of this specific implementation of distance learning.
Prudence, I want to drill down a little bit more on your previous point concerning race and class, because we do know that a lot of the folks, I'm thinking about the folks who were considered essential workers, particularly those who are working in transportation or in food service and the like, who are low wage workers often, or a lower middle class, working class folks who may not be able to stay home at all, who will have to send their children off to school. I mean, doesn't this have the potential to further these economic inequalities, if that's the case? And also potentially health inequities, too. If you're forced to send your kid to school and can't protect them at home, don't they also run a higher risk of getting sick?
Absolutely. I mean, so I absolutely agree with you. And the reason it's important to think about this, if the schools are not open, what happens to those kids? That's just the bottom line. And many of those parents have always been working during this pandemic for the last 5 months or so. They have been working, and their children, many of them, have been at home. It is the case that in some districts across the country, some communities, there are some who are trying to pick up the slack and try to support those families. But those children are the ones who are most at risk for falling further behind, if we want to use that phrase, but for actually not getting the kind of access to quality instruction or even sustained instruction, like kids who will be a part of these learning pods or whose parents can work at home. So they are definitely challenged. Those families are challenged. And another thing that people don't talk about, because it is probably too difficult to talk about, parents have to consider, those who are forming learning pods have been talking about how to be more inclusive in terms of kids who come from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. And they are also aware that those kids are also at higher risk for the virus because their parents are frontline or essential workers. And so then you're having parents and communities wrestling with that question when the pods have been a reaction to trying to kind of minimize to the extent possible one's risk of getting the virus.
Christina, you've spoken to parents about doing this. Are many of them conscious of the potential that learning pods have to create a more unequal system in our education right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, what the protest this summer really did was, you know, elevate the issues of equity in parents' mind that, you know, some of them probably were already there, but some of them really hadn't perhaps thought about this. And there's definitely memes that you see going around saying, well, parents, you know, if you put Black Lives Matter on your, you know, social media stream or something like that, but now you're planning to, you know, gather all your kids together in a pandemic pod, you know, what does that say about you? So, you know, what I'm seeing, at least in some parents' conversation, is like wrestling with these really deep, thorny issues of equity and who are we, who knows about our pod? Who are we inviting to our pod? Should we sponsor a child for our pod? Should we, you know, just all these kinds of really fraught conversations. But I do think there's consciousness of it there. You know, but I will say that, you know, one thing also to note is that, you know, we're writing about this, you know, sort of this middle class phenomenon of families coming together for this. But, you know, as Dr. Carter has mentioned, families, you know, this is something that requires us all to rely on all of our networks. And this is not something that's necessarily a class issue. I have a friend who is a teacher, who is a teacher of low income, students from low income families. And she says she often, when she would start her class, there would be like a couple of kids there. Because these families, somebody would have to work, so they drop the kids off at somebody else's house who has internet connections. That's a pod of sorts. People are trying to do the best they can in a really challenging situation.
Let's talk about funding for schools, Prudence. What does funding need to look like in the fall so that schools that have the resources could have the resources they need to support families who cannot afford to pay for this extra care?
Well, some of the things that we have to consider if kids are going to go back into schools, particularly, is that the schools have the sufficient resources for PPE, for safety, for health and safety, that's first. And so, and it also is the case for social distancing. Will there need to be extra personnel, more teachers, teachers' aides, teachers' assistants? Will they have to be monitors in school? And in addition, you have to think about extra after-school care for these families. If the parents are still working, what kinds of programs will need to be developed? And some schools have those programs attached to their school program. Will there be sufficient funds? And for at the moment, we know that there's not a lot of support that's actually coming to local school districts. So this is a logistical nightmare and so a challenge and a nightmare for so many districts to think about what we can actually do. And knowing that this additional level for many districts that are already cash strapped, this additional level of challenge is one that is really something that has to be thought through. And people are doing it on the same budget. It's not like there has been an infusion of resources since the COVID-19 pandemic.
You know, Prudence, one thing I think about being in New York City, I have a 6-month-old and I keep thinking, my God, just getting into kindergarten in New York City is almost as competitive as getting into Harvard. How competitive is it going to be getting into some of these pods if this is the way we're headed, Prudence?
Well, for the designer pods that you mentioned earlier, there may be competition, but competitive, if they're pods and we're talking about competitive, I mean, I imagine that pods can't be more than, you know, 5 to 6 families, if that. In my mind, I'm thinking 2 to 3. I mean, health and safety have to be first. And someone actually tweeted at me yesterday, no pods, absolutely no pods, because we can't afford to continue to transmit and spread the COVID-19 virus. So if you have a really big pod, it kind of defeats the purpose. You know, we might as well be back in school. I can't imagine that, you know, what competition looks like is who's going to have access to and try to hoard, as some social scientists call, the teachers who may be available to teach or the tutors. That's where the competition is, Tanzina, in terms of trying to get the resources to support the pod.
Christina, in terms of the parents that you've talked to who are considering this or thinking about how equitable it is there any, are there any tips for parents who want to create pods but who also want to keep that level of equity in mind?
So there was a couple of interesting, you know, things that I was hearing from parents. And I'll just say, you know, at this point, we don't know how successful any of this will be. But one, you know, suggestion I was hearing from one parent was to try to form a pod based on your child's class. You know, so wait until an actual classroom has formed and then you have a student and then you have a list of students there. And then you might create a pod there, because the idea is that the school will have already, you know, naturally have tried to create a balanced classroom. And so from those students, then you can create a more balanced pod. The idea then being that you're not just using your own network, but that you're kind of spreading out a little bit beyond the folks who just your next door neighbors or something like that. I know that some other parents are reaching out to community groups and just other sorts of entities just to make sure that they are letting a broad group of parents know, hey, you know, this is an option that's being discussed. So those are some ideas that I've heard of. And then, you know, I think another idea was just to say, you know, if the issue is the socialization, you know, just sort of stick with that as opposed to hiring a teacher.
Parents doing a lot, as always. Christina Samuels is an associate editor for Education Week covering educational equity, and Prudence Carter is a professor and the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a Takeaway with Tanzina Vega.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who've been tested for COVID-19, you might be surprised at the cost.
I received a bill from a medical physician service, I'm holding it in my hand right now, for $1,888. Hi, my name is Ryan Hampton. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada.
Ryan is not alone. While experts have been saying for months that testing for COVID-19 is a critical piece of containing the virus, many Americans say they're getting unexpected bills for the service.
And I immediately thought, this is wrong.
Ryan got tested in late March. After having traveled in the United States, he and his fiance both felt sick when they got home to Nevada. So his doctor sent him to a local hospital for a test, something that he didn't think to question. And he only just got this bill a few days ago, months after he took the test. And now he's trying to dispute it. All this despite the fact that back in March, Congress mandated that health insurers cover COVID-19 testing with no cost to patients. And it set aside testing money for those without insurance. But some people like Ryan who have insurance have still been faced with surprise bills in the hundreds or thousands. So what's going on? And what do we all need to know to make sure that as many people as possible can get tests that they can afford? To help me understand all that, I'm talking to Karen Politz. She's a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation, where she's been tracking COVID test prices and payment policies.
There are protections that require that tests and related services should be covered if you have health insurance. But those protections are not airtight and mistakes can happen. And when that does, people can be left with a lot of money.
You said mistakes can happen, but what type of mistakes are we talking about? What are some of the places where people are getting surprised?
A lot of the problems we see happen when people who have insurance get tests or related services out of network. Almost all health insurance has a network where you will get the most complete coverage under your policy. But you may go out of network. You may be sent to, you know, a test provider that you wouldn't normally go see for a lab test, or you may just go to, you know, the Walmart parking lot or someplace. And that's where the problems arise. A test provider that's out of network may not bill your insurance company directly. Instead, they may just ask you for cash up front and let you deal with your insurance company. If they're out of network, they haven't negotiated a discounted price with your health plan. That's kind of the point of having a provider network. Instead, the out-of-network lab or clinic or doctor can charge whatever they want to charge. Now, federal law says your health plan has to pay that amount, whatever is charged, but only if the provider has posted that test online. And then finally, you may go in for a test but not get it. Sometimes, you know, there aren't tests available, or the doctor may say, well, you know, I want to test you for some other stuff and see. And if you don't end up getting a test, then you will get a bill for all of those related services, for the visit and for the other tests. And those may be covered by your health plan, but your deductible and copays and other cost sharing may apply.
This is a public health crisis. Why isn't it a public service to give Americans these tests? Why do we have to rely on the type of sort of health insurance that a lot of Americans don't even have?
Well, you know, some people are talking about that maybe this should be a publicly financed service. But right now, we're paying for COVID tests the way we pay for other healthcare. So that may be your insurance, that may be you paying out of pocket, it may be some combination of those, or it may be you finding a place where you can get free coverage. You know, there are clinics and other safety net providers that that will provide all healthcare services to people, you know, on a sliding scale basis if they qualify.
There are millions of Americans with no insurance. Do they have any options?
They do, but they have to figure it out. States have the option now under federal law to extend Medicaid coverage just to cover the cost of COVID testing for their uninsured residents. And a handful of states have done that so far. You can also look at community health centers, clinics, which often provide services free or on a sliding scale for the uninsured. And finally, a new federal provider relief fund has been established. It's got tens of billions of dollars in it, and it's for hospitals and doctors and clinics to reimburse them for a lot of costs related to the pandemic, including a new option where providers can bill this fund for their uninsured patients for the cost of COVID tests and treatment. So if you don't have insurance, you should ask whoever is taking care of you if they would be willing to submit your bill to that provider relief fund instead of sending it to you.
How much does a test actually cost, Karen? What are you finding in your research?
We looked at the largest hospitals in every state in DC to see if they had posted the price for the COVID test online. About three quarters of them had. And those prices, now this is just for the test, ranged from $20 to $850. But it might not include the visit. If you go to a hospital or an emergency room, for example, and a doctor sees you, you're going to get a separate bill for the visit from that doctor. It might not include the specimen collection. And sometimes additional tests will be ordered. If you've got kind of respiratory distress, they may order a whole respiratory panel to see, could it be COVID or could it be flu or could it be something else? So all of those related services are in addition to the cost of the test.
In places where testing is regulated, or should I say where regular testing of employees or students is expected, who bears the brunt of that cost?
Well, hopefully, if that's required by your employer or your school system, they'll provide the tests for free and they'll pay for the costs. Otherwise, that could be on you. The law requiring health insurance to cover COVID tests and related services only applies to individual tests that are ordered because there's a medical need for you. Any kind of broader kind of community screening, that is not covered, and your insurance company doesn't have to pay anything for that.
Do you still recommend that people continue to get tested at this state in the pandemic?
The experts are telling us that testing is key to finding our way out of this mess, but for that to work, and they want us to get tested so that they can get an accurate count of the cases and where they're spreading, and so that they can identify people who have coronavirus and isolate them so that they don't spread it. So, of course, that only works if people can get to the test promptly, if they can get the results promptly, and if they're not deterred by, you know, the fear of big out-of-pocket costs. So, you know, this whole payment problem is hindering that goal.
Karen Politz is a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation, and we've linked to her work on COVID testing prices at thetakeaway.org. Karen, thanks again.
Thank you.
Listeners, we want to know what your COVID testing experience has been like. So tell us about it. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and leave a message. Or you can shoot us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway.
For so many Black people, The Wiz feels like home. The New Stage revival has Broadway buzzing. And as it gears up for a national tour, well, consider the impact this story continues to have 50 years down the yellow brick road. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on the next Notes from America as we pay tribute to The Wiz. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
On August 3, 2019, the border city of El Paso, Texas was forever changed. 1 year ago today, a gunman shot and killed 23 people in a Walmart in El Paso. The gunman had written and published a white supremacist manifesto just moments before the attack. The massacre is considered to be one of the deadliest anti-Latino attacks in modern U.S. history. The victims included both adults and children, and both U.S. and Mexican citizens, many of whom had crossed into town to shop at the Walmart. 1 year on, we're going to check in on El Paso and what justice looks like, or what it should look like, for survivors and their families, many of whom have also faced the brunt of years of border policies from the United States and Mexican governments. I'm joined now by two guests. Renee Klajic is a reporter for El Paso Matters. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Monica Martinez is a historian and the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Monica joined us last year to discuss the shooting when it first happened. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Monica.
Thank you for having me.
Renee, let's start with you. What do we know about the victims and the survivors of the shooting today?
Well, you know, it's important to remember that both victims and survivors are, that this was a binational tragedy, and that people were targeted who were from both the United States and Mexico. There have been 23 dead from this tragedy, and, you know, El Paso were a resilient community, but there are still people hospitalized from injuries sustained during the shooting. So there's still so much pain, and a year later, we're still struggling to kind of reconcile all the pain that this tragedy caused.
Monica, you joined us after the shooting last year to talk about how that incident and that shooting fits into the history of anti-Latino violence at the border. What's on your mind today, 1 year later?
Well, in my work, Reckoning with Histories of Racial Violence, I've seen that we have to think about the multiple steps required for seeking justice. So this means, of course, prosecuting those accountable for committing horrific acts of violence like this massacre, but also thinking about the systems that allowed these acts of racial violence to occur in the first place. So we have to consider collective responsibility for human rights violations. And so that's really a call for everybody to consider what we have to be doing as individuals to try to reckon this horrific act. Congresswoman Veronica Escobar recently described the massacre as a result of two different pandemics. First, gun violence, and second, hate against Latinos. And I think she's absolutely right. So, you know, we can think about hate as a pandemic, as a social illness. And that's actually how anti-lynching activists 100 years ago taught Americans about the immorality of lynchings. And so it's a useful analogy for today because we can think about the multiple symptoms of hate that has been targeted against Latinos, right? Hate spreads like a disease. So when presidents or governors or senators or the media use racist rhetoric, it spreads hate and it actually inspires hate crimes and acts of domestic violence. We're seeing that today, and we saw that take place 100 years ago. And we can think about the different kind of symptoms of anti-Latino hate. First, there's the undeniable increase in hate crimes that have been reported by the FBI and by other watch groups. The massacre in El Paso is the most egregious of these in the past year. But we also have to think about the second kind of symptoms, which takes place in policy, brutal border policing and draconian immigration policies like family separation, right? I think about the over 5,000 children that were separated from their families. I think about that as being a crime against humanity. And a third symptom of anti-Latino hate is that racist and dehumanizing representations of Latinos is so effective that everyday Americans who don't see themselves as hating Latinos, they still tolerate this inhumane treatment, the brutal policing, and the regular violation of rights of both foreign nationals and American citizens. So society as a whole is infected with discriminatory perceptions that allow society to condone this kind of injustice. And so we really need an awakening for people to call for drastic reforms, but also to change our own perceptions that allow us to condone this kind of behavior.
Renee, when you think about, I mean, you're originally from El Paso and you moved back earlier this year. How has the community changed in the past year?
I mean, if we're looking for a silver lining, I think it's that this horrific mass shooting has made a lot of El Pasoans realize how much they love this community and how much they want to work to protect it. So there's been such a surge of local pride in response to it. You know, the hashtag El Paso Strong is ubiquitous. When you drive around the city, you see murals, you see bumper stickers. And I mean, today and this weekend, there have been so many different types of memorialization, lots of socially distanced COVID forms of collective memorializing. I think there was a drive-through memorial last night. But, you know, just an outpouring of love for this community, and not just El Paso. Like I said, you know, we're a binational community, and people on both sides of the border are both mourning but also expressing solidarity. And I think that if anything, our community has become stronger and more resilient in the face of this hate-fueled act, and that love for this area has grown, and you know, so many people have realized how special it is. I mean, even as someone who has moved back home in the time since the shooting happened, I feel a tremendous amount of pride to be from El Paso. And part of why this area is so special is because we're a border community, because we're a binational community. That's our strength. So I think that's been a real lesson, has been seeing that outpouring of love and local pride.
Monica, El Paso, as we mentioned, is a border town, and some of the victims of the massacre were Mexican citizens. Has that in any way influenced the commemoration of the shooting or the aftermath of the shooting?
Well, I think absolutely. And you know, it's not lost on me that historically border communities that thrive, right, where you see people not seeing an international border as a division, but seeing, you know, that these communities, both Juarez and El Paso, have grown as cities in strength together over time, that those kinds of communities have been under attack. Those were targeted with violence, especially because they embody a spirit of living sin fronteras, right? That these are people who are united. Soccer teams, you know, that play on both sides of the border, children that move back and forth for schooling, families that live on both sides, people who own businesses on both sides and work on both sides. And to see that kind of a community attacked is especially horrific, right? Because it's an attack on that way of life.
Renee, let me ask you here about how white supremacy has played out in that region. I mean, El Paso also has a history of racism. Monica has done a lot of work on the long tail history here. But more recently, how would you say that's played out?
Well, yeah, you're absolutely correct that, you know, the ideologies that fueled this act are not new to the borderlands. We've had a long history of racism and of white supremacy and ideologies of white supremacy that have shaped and framed this community both institutionally and implicitly. I mean, there, you know, throughout El Paso's history, there has been de facto segregation, racial covenants for homeowners. There's been a movement in El Paso recently to change the names of some schools. Robert E. Lee Elementary School has a renaming process in effect right now. There were also six school names that were named by the KKK when the KKK took power of the school board in El Paso in 1922. And there is some discussion about changing those names because those schools were named after slave owners, slave traders. So that conversation's happening. But you know, there's a powerful legacy of racism in this community. And I mean, even the way that the military-industrial apparatus at the border is constructed, you know, there was a quarantine policy here for over 40 years that forcibly bathed Mexicans in chemicals when they were entering this country. That, you know, people don't know about that history. Most, like El Pasoans, don't know about that history, even though that policy was in effect here for, you know, almost half a century. So those things leave a strong imprint of racism and inequality on a community, and they have shaped how people have lived their lives here, and how, even though we are a binational community and we're completely interconnected, there's also pronounced inequality along lines of race, indigeneity, you know, class, and all of those things are interconnected.
Monica, when we look at, you mentioned a lot of this in the earlier segment, just in terms of how violence against Latinos has been perpetrated. But I wonder, Have we learned anything from the El Paso shooting when we look at the country more broadly and we look at how the state of anti-Latino violence in this country, has anything changed since a year ago?
Well, unfortunately, I haven't seen change, and it's devastating. I think that when we were last speaking, you know, we were sort of there were still ongoing conversations about family separation, and that being a flashpoint for Americans to sort of have a new consciousness to say our immigration policies need to be changed. During the Democratic presidential debates, I was really taken aback by, I really think that what we need is Americans to vote, right? And to be committed to removing local, state, and federal administrations and elected officials who continue to circulate anti-Latino hateful rhetoric and who continue to endorse draconian immigration policies. You know, family separation is something that is still ongoing today, right? The COVID-19 pandemic and epidemic has only emboldened our current federal administration to continue to encourage and to inflict upon parents making these terrible choices between, you know, allowing their children to be separated from them and released from detention when the federal administration has every authority to release families together. And so I think that we still, 100 years later, are too often separating, right? We give too much authority to the federal government to create, to commit these crimes against humanity. And we separate those actions from the brutality of the horrific act of this massacre in El Paso. And we have to think about them as social ills that have to be remedied at the same time, right? We have to condemn white power, domestic terror actions, but we also have to condemn governors and senators and presidents and local officials that continue to perpetuate this kind of fear and division and racial hostility. So, one of the most powerful ways that Latinos can memorialize the victims in El Paso and stand against this violence and hate is to vote, to show our strength in numbers, and to remind anyone who believes otherwise that we are not going anywhere, that our voices will be heard, and that we are demanding reform and we are demanding justice.
Renee, I'm just thinking as Monica is talking about government officials and what they can and should do differently. Beto O'Rourke was running for president when this happened a year ago. I'm wondering whether or not he's continued to be involved at any point in the memorials for the victims?
You know what? I'm not sure. I know that he's been interviewed for some like year later segments, but I'm not certain to what extent he's been involved in local memorials. I would imagine so.
What are those memorials looking like, Renee? I mean, we are also, as Monica mentioned, we are in the middle of a pandemic, and there are the rules have changed decidedly for how we engage with each other socially. And I'm wondering if you can tell us what these memorials or commemorations of the anniversary of the shooting are looking like, given COVID-19 restrictions.
Absolutely. You know, I'll tell you about one especially that I found really moving. A number of local florists came together and created 23 floral sculptures of human forms made out of grass and plants and flowers to commemorate each of the 23 people who died. And the sculpture for the youngest person who died, the 15-year-old, they covered with the most flowers because they said that person had not yet fully bloomed when their life was cut short, which I found so moving. But that memorial and many others were drive-by. There have been lots of luminarias, which is when you put like a candle in a paper bag. It's something very common here for Christmas to drive through a neighborhood and illuminate the roadway with luminarias. But yet lots of different forms of collective expression, you know, online gatherings, drive-by memorials, and then an incredible amount of public art as well that we've seen over the entire year, but also right now. I mean, like this floral art installation that I mentioned, there have been so many different types of visual like changes to the visual landscape to commemorate this tragedy, to indicate that we won't forget and that we are a strong, united community in the face of hate and in response to it. Creating beauty in response to it. It's really been very moving to see.
Renee Klajic is a reporter for El Paso Matters, and Monica Munoz Martinez is a historian and the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.